Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, Warner Brothers is trying to figure out what to do with Harry Potter. And not having a great deal of luck, rumors started circulating that the seemingly cursed Fantastic Beasts franchise, which has never put up the box office numbers Warner's hoped for, in addition to being saddled with PR nightmares Johnny Depp and Ezra Miller, has been kind of more or less sotto voce canceled following the disastrous outing of the latest, The Secrets of Dumbledore. Those rumors picked up steam when WB head David Zaslav said that the studio is trying to figure out what to do with Harry Potter, a franchise that hasn't had a movie in 15 years. We all kind of scratched our heads at that one since, you know, there's been three of them. Technically not Harry Potter movies exactly, but, you know. Anyway, in his latest newsletter highlighting the travails of the franchise, Matt Bellany says the series is almost certainly dead, and it's still unclear what exactly WB is going to do with all of this fabulously valuable intellectual property. Part of the problem from their POV is that Rowling has a hammerlock on the rights. WB can remake the eight movies in the series without her approval, but that's about it. They can't adapt the hit play, The Cursed Child, for the big screen without her signing off, and they can't really do anything with any spinoff materials. It's not like they can just pick up fanfic and adapt that. She has, again, sign-off. It's worth noting here that Rowling has no imperative to do anything whatsoever. I mean, she is still making tons of money with the original books, right? I checked Amazon today before we taped the show. The Sorcerer's Stone, still in the top 100 of Kindle books and still in the top 500 of paperbacks. That's all books, folks. That's just, people are just buying these books all the time still. I don't know what to tell you. The Harry Potter attraction at Universal Studios Florida continues to be enormously popular, as is the Leaves Den attraction in London. Families continue to love the adventures of the boy who lived. Indeed, my own family does. My wife reads Harry Potter to my 7-year-old daughter every night. And while my wife and I, were a little bit too old for the books, by the time the first one came out, I was 15, and thus starting to watch Stanley Kubrick movies, not really, you know, my time to read the YA fiction. Kids today still love them, still love these books, popular as a Halloween costume song all over my neighborhood. I don't know what to tell you guys, but they very specifically love Harry Potter. It's like very specifically, we like Harry Potter, and all the spinoffs that have nothing to do with him may be doomed to failure. I don't know, at least at the $200 million budget per movie level, right? I'm somewhat skeptical that the overly online controversies about Rowling and her statements about trans folks have a huge impact at the box office, but it definitely is something on the back of Hollywood's mind. Alyssa, as a Harry Potter fan, what is WB supposed to do with their marquee property?
Oh, man. It's a hard one. And, you know, if I knew, maybe David Zaslav would be paying me millions of dollars instead of, you know, me just faffing around at the Washington Post opinion section. It's hard to answer in part because I think, in theory, WB did the right thing, right? I mean, they greenlit a prequel that was sort of backstory on characters that you knew about that sort of set up the big conflict. I mean, it's almost a, you know, Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power play. It's like, this is how we get to the big bad. It also, you know, takes a character who, you know, I think fans were interested in and who was revealed over the course of the series to have an intriguing backstory, but that wasn't fully revealed in the same way that, say, you know, James and Lily Potter's story was in the original text and fleshed it out. It tried sort of building on the existing magical concepts. I mean, these are all the things that I basically think you want to do if you're going to do a spinoff of an existing franchise. You know, you want to look for the spots where things are intriguing but not fully revealed. You want to expand the concepts. You know, you want to have a conflict that people can sort of hook into. And it didn't work. And you know what? It's not always going to work. And I think that Marvel's success, Star Wars to a lesser extent, has sort of sowed the sense among movie makers that there's always an appetite for more. And also that fans always want the world to get bigger. And Harry Potter itself is a pretty big story. I mean, it's sort of magically expansive. It has a lot of characters. There's a lot of space for people to sort of imagine themselves in the existing nooks and crannies. And, you know, maybe the, you know, I think the success of the original actually may have made it harder to expand the world, because if there's already enough there for everyone to sort of latch onto and find anew, and if the appeal in particular is of sharing these stories and these characters with a younger generation, then expanding and getting away from that core is maybe sort of behind the besides the point. I mean, I think it is inevitable that these movies will be remade at some point. I don't know how that will work, but I think that Warner's actually basically did the things that you're supposed to do and had some really bad luck.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my question here is, how much of the appeal of Harry Potter is intrinsically bound up in Harry Potter, right? I mean, we don't call them the Hogwarts books. We don't call them, yeah, you know, the Wizarding books. It's the Harry Potter books. He is the figure into which every lonely child can pour himself and say, maybe I'm magic and can go to the magic school. And
Sonny, you are magic.
Well, I know I am magic. I'm saying the rest of the people who aren't as lucky as me. I think that there is a very specific Star Wars problem here, which is that every attempt to get away from the Skywalker saga has failed because Star Wars actually only is interesting on the level of family melodrama. And I wonder how much of that is true for Harry Potter, which is only interesting as a stand-in for the eternal underdog who needs to triumph over a terrible monster.
Well, but I think that's true. That undersells the extent to which people identify in particular, I think, with Hermione Granger, who is just a particular kind of character who is just born to appeal to the kinds of bookish girls who would be reading the books in the first place, but then also who are going to become children's librarians and parents who want to pass this, you know, the book down to their daughters. You know, it's a great sort of updated Cinderella story. And I think that character has been hard to replace as well. I mean, you know, you've had the attempt to do that with Tina in the Fantastic Beasts movies, but I think she has not really clicked in the same way. And, you know, I think another challenge for the Fantastic Beasts movies is that there is something particularly appealing about that journey from childhood through adolescence to adulthood. And the prequels are largely about adults. And, you know, that may be the kind of thing that sells, that, you know, maybe that makes it more like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but it doesn't quite capture that particular, you know, the end of innocence and the move into something else that's such a key part of the Harry Potter books.
Yeah. Peter, we a couple weeks back discussed IP mismanagement with regard to Star Wars. And, you know, I don't know if you guys have been keeping up with Andor, which has gotten better as it has gone along. And, you know, maybe it's back. Maybe Star Wars is back. But that whole situation there is still unsatisfactory from Disney's perspective, certainly, just in terms of actual box office success, ratings, et cetera, et cetera. So do you see something similar at work here? I mean, what could Warner Brothers learn from where Disney has failed?
I do think there's some similarity, although I disagree with your assertion earlier that the Star Wars saga is really only successful when it's about the Skywalkers, because there's a bunch of side stories going back to all of the expanded universe stuff that Alyssa has talked about, you know, that I was at least aware of when I was a kid. And now the Dave Filoni cartoon series Andor is really quite good. The Mandalorian might not be completely groundbreaking, but it's quite enjoyable. And it's not about the Skywalkers.
Except when eventually was, when Luke shows up.
It's not primarily a family domestic drama.
I'm sorry, the expanded universe stuff is all well and good, but the only thing that has gotten butts in seats in the into theaters to see these movies is stuff that revolves around the Skywalker saga.
Well, Rogue One did pretty well,
which is a prequel to Star Wars: A New Hope.
Yes, but I think the thing that you're getting at is that the side stories, what even the ones that are relatively successful, even the ones that I think are quite good, and I think Andor is really quite good, not just getting better, but it started strong and has done better than my expectations in a lot of ways, exceeded my expectations. I think the thing that you're getting at is that the giant box office phenomenon, where Star Wars is not just something that some people like, a kind of niche culture, the giant box office phenomenon where it is the culture, where everyone knows Star Wars, is a product of the Skywalkers. But there are a bunch of people who are sort of more niche fans who are into all the other stuff as well. But Harry Potter doesn't even seem to have much of that. I mean, Fantastic Beasts really collapsed as the films went on. They have not... I'm not, able to think of a single successful story outside of the Harry Potter part of it. But I think the question that we're sort of all raising here implicitly is just, what is it that people like about the Harry Potter series, the movies and the books? Is it that they like the central trio, or the central duo of Harry Potter and Hermione and the other guy?
Ron Weasley.
Jeez. I forgot him because he's designed to be forgettable, right? Is that what they like about the character dynamic? Is what they like about it that the characters start, at quite young, right? Like not even adolescent yet. And then they grow older and the series, both the book and the movie series tracked a kind of childhood development, right? Like they came out over a period of about 10 years. So if you started reading them or watching them when you were 8 or 10 years old, by the time you were done, you would be at the end of high school or whatever it was. Like, I don't know. I don't recall the exact publishing dates, but like they tracked the development of the readers in a certain way. Is what they liked about it that it was set at school? I mean, this is something we haven't talked about very much, except for that you mentioned that it's not called Hogwarts. But I think the school aspect and the fact that that Rowling was writing in the tradition of British school fiction, which is a sort of a genre from the middle of the 1900s that was like quite common in 1950. There was just all of this sort of boarding school fiction that she is borrowing from and then turning into a fantasy series and adding a bunch of fantasy tropes. Is it the fact that like it's about kids who are dealing with authority figures? Because that's something that's very important here. It's like these are stories about how kids navigate the world of adult rules that have been placed upon them and learn both to survive within that, but also how to escape that and to make decisions on their own. And that's adults here are, the school administrators as well as parents. I don't think anybody knows the answer to that. And maybe the answer is it's all of those things, that Harry Potter was successful because it was a perfect synthesis of elements. And it's not really going to be possible to synthesize those elements again. So I think my answer is Warner Brothers should just give up and remake Harry Potter and just like do the whole series again. They're trying to capture the same magic. The only way you are going to capture the same magic is by literally capturing the same magic, by just doing the same thing again. Otherwise, what they're going to need to do is tell completely different stories set in the same universe that have some tangential connection to the world. Here is the story of a professor who, was at Hogwarts or was at a competing school or was at here's a story of somebody who wanted to become a professor of magic at Hogwarts and what they had to go through. Whatever it is, like your choices are tell niche stories that may or may not take off, or just do the same thing again because that's what we know that people like. And what they've tried to do is, well, we're going to sort of do the same thing again, except not and without some of the stuff that people obviously gravitated towards. And that just doesn't seem like the right decision. The other thing is, the Fantastic Beasts movies are not terrible exactly, but they're just not very good. And the Harry Potter movies are good. And I say that as somebody who has not read the novels. And so I feel like I can judge the movies on their own. They are very appealing, especially the later ones from three on. But even at the beginning, I found the first couple really quite charming. The performances are, they're not like
excellent, Oscar-worthy, whatever, but like the actors and the dynamic between them is quite charming. All of the sort of the ins and outs of the school, really kind of wonderful to just experience visually. And they're good, effective, populist blockbusters. The Fantastic Beasts movies are often pretty and boring. They are just boring. And you have to make good movies.
And I will say one real problem with the Fantastic Beasts book is that it was an attempt to jump, to piggyback on existing IP, i.e., you know, like Newt Scamander is the literal author of a textbook that, you know, the kids in Harry Potter study as part of one of their, you know, their Care of Magical Creatures class. And, you know, that it was something that Rowling like wrote as a spinoff that where I think the proceeds went to charity. But the idea that you need to like, that was the thing where you need to like jerry rig like a guy who's like really shy and into animals onto this existing story that they were going to tell. I think that was really weird branding, right? Like, why is it like Fantastic Beasts, the Crimes of Dumbledore, like, or the, you know, the Secrets of Dumbledore, or the Crimes of Grindelwald. I mean, just like, just, do like, you know, young Dumbledore, like young hot Dumbledore. That was what the people wanted and they didn't do it.
By the way, that's my rap name, Young Dumbledore.
Young hot Dumbledore. I guess this gets me to my last point, which is, isn't the real issue here that they are trying, like, they're trying to reverse engineer something for the big screen or the small screen based on stuff that already exists instead of having Rowling do what she does best? She needs to write another series of books.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, she is doing that. They're just detective novels where she like gets revenge on her enemies. And they're actually pretty good detective novels. She needs to write
a Harry Potter series of books where she gets revenge on her enemies, not these detective books. Because I like the whole one thing we haven't discussed in the reason for the success of these movies is that people enjoy watching the things on the screen that they read and loved and shared with each other, right? That is why they wanted to go see these movies, and that is why they are often very plain and straightforward, is because they are movies that are showing you the things that happened in the books for the most part. I mean, not, you know, obviously there are some changes, but like I really feel like the issue here is if Warner Brothers wants another run of successful Harry Potter films, they should just throw a bucket of money at J.K. Rowling and say, I know you have everything you could possibly want, but here's a little bit more. Now go write some books.
So last I checked, she didn't just have everything she wanted. She was literally a billionaire. And
She lives in a castle in Scotland.
I believe she is the first and maybe only person to ever earn $1 billion just from writing books. There's not an amount of money that Warner Brothers could throw at her that would.
I agree.
Make a
which
difference.
Which is, you know, look, again, this is the real problem here is that they need her sign off on everything. There's no reason for her to, she's the Joker in this situation. You know, she's just laughing and saying there is nothing you can do to me that will make me either A, sign off on something I don't want to do, or B, you know, sit. But like, I really think the answer here is like J.K. Rowling just needs to write more Harry Potter books and then they can make those into movies and people will go see them or not. But this whole trying to jerry-rig a universe out of like scribs and scraps of everything that's in her notebooks is insane. It's never going to work.
Just remake the originals, except for every movie that they had, for each book should be two books and the last book should be four books. Each book should be two movies, and the last book should be four movies.
So we're looking at a 16 movie series. Is that right? Is that what we're looking at?
There were so many pages that weren't perfectly translated in the first set of movies.
Or do a dark and gritty like adult reboot where Dumbledore, you know.
Zack Snyder presents Harry Potter.
There we go.
Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. And it's actually just Harry Potter stoning a philosopher to death. All right. So what do we think?
Looking forward to ripped Harry Potter.
So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Warner Brothers has yet to sign off on my amazing Zack Snyder Harry Potter idea? Peter.
Yeah, sure. Controversy.
Controversy.
Okay. That's a silly exit question. Make sure to listen to our special bonus episode, which will be less silly. Alyssa and Peter and I are going to be talking about good kids' books and, you know, what we recommend folks read. So, Alyssa's putting together a nice little list of books for folks. There's lots of controversy about, you know, who should be reading what and blah, blah, blah. But we're gonna give you some nice normal choices for a nice normal podcast. All right, now on to the main event. Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. The sequel to the $700 million domestic grossing Black Panther has big shoes to fill, not just in terms of business, though I'm sure Disney could use $1 billion off box office bucks right now, given everything that's going on in the world of streaming and stock prices, et cetera, et cetera. But the original film also scored a coveted A+ from CinemaScore. It was 96% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes and 100% fresh from top critics. And it was the first MCU picture to earn a Best Picture nomination. Sadly, since that film's debut, the world lost star Chadwick Boseman to colon cancer, which, in addition to being a tragedy to his friends and family, scrambled the MCU's overall plan, not just for this movie, I think, but for the franchise in general. Director Ryan Coogler was very firm in his decision not to recast King T'Challa, who was the titular defender of Wakanda, but that left open some questions as to what should be done. Black Panther Wakanda Forever is basically three movies in one. The first is a mournful ode to Boseman. It opens and closes with tributes to the actor via the death of the character, who passes off screen to an unnamed illness. The second movie is a fairly straightforward action-adventure movie with big, mediocre CGI set pieces. And the third is an extension of the Marvel Cinematic Universe as we are introduced to the character Ironheart. We spent a lot of time with Julia Louis-Dreyfus for some reason. She's been seen on some of the TV shows on Disney Plus. There's a lot of Marvel stuff in this movie, a lot of Marvel stuff, and that's a big reason why the whole thing is kind of a cluttered mess. I think Ryan Coogler could have made a $200 million mourning movie, just like a movie in mourning and about sadness and like how to overcome grief and that sort of thing. Or Marvel could have, you know, just kind of pushed that aside and made this all about introducing, you know, kind of lame new characters. And then you could have done both of those with the standard CGI set piece. Oh, look, here's our third action battle on a floating whatever. But doing all of this simultaneously, it just, the whole thing is a slog. It's just a huge slog. I haven't even talked about the introduction of the film's nemesis, Namor, who is no longer an Atlantean, as he is in the comics. I guess they were trying to avoid the whole Aquaman trap here. But instead, he's the descendant of a Mesoamerican culture that was forced into the ocean after the arrival of the conquistadors. They drank some vibranium juice, and that gave them gills, kind of. They could absorb oxygen. It doesn't matter. The whole point here is that colonialism is bad. Colonialism is bad. That's the lesson here again. And one problem with going back to this theme is that it makes no sense for the Talokan Water Kingdom to go to war with Wakanda, even with the carefully constructed Rube Goldberg device of a plot they have here. There's a vibranium detecting device, and that's a scientist. That's Ironheart. They gotta protect her from the Talokanites. I don't know, whatever. Another problem here is that the initial film covered very similar ground and did it better. Michael B. Jordan's Killmonger was basically right in that movie about the cowardice of Wakanda, which kind of sat idly by as Africa was carved up by the colonial powers. Rather than building on Wakanda's status now as an undisputed world power, is basically the most powerful nation in the world, kind of. They don't really get into that very much, which is kind of interesting, but whatever. The film retreats. It retreats again, and it treats Wakanda as a nation that is just kind of bullied and put upon, and they're standing up for themselves, and they're saying, but when you're a world power, you have more responsibilities than that. There's a version of film criticism that is kind of lame, and I don't like to do it, and it is this. It's right, quote, this movie should have been a different movie, and it would have been better if it was that movie, end quote, right? That's not a great form of criticism, but I, like, really feel like that's the case here. There's a better version of this movie that treats Talokan as a more straightforwardly villainous, I don't know, reincarnation of the Aztec Empire, right? Like, getting in there and doing some human sacrifices with vibranium weapons, something, just literally anything. Like, you could even pull stuff from the comic books, have Namor, say, drown New York City and threaten to do the same to every other major city in the world if the world doesn't stop trying to steal their vibranium. Something like that. You wouldn't need to change too much from the film as it exists. Just make it more simple. Just simplify it a little bit. Even if you don't do that, one thing you could do is bring some lights to the sets, because this movie is exceptionally hard to see in a number of places. Like, I watched it on IMAX in a standard kind of multiplex IMAX, and I literally could not make out what was going on the screen in certain scenes, particularly at night on the riverbank, and then in the underwater city that Namor runs. It looks so bad. I cannot imagine how bad this movie looks in like your kind of standard shoebox multiplex. I've heard some folks who are not thrilled with how it looks. I'll put it that way. I don't know, man. I the whole thing just doesn't really work for me. It's got some good performances. It has a nice tribute to Bozeman. The film really peaks emotionally in the first 5 minutes, which is another problem. But in all, it's just kind of a disappointing slog. Peter, am I being too harsh here? What did you make of Black Panther: Wakanda Forever?
I don't think you're being too harsh, but I want to start by giving this movie some credit. I do think it's kind of ambitious in interesting ways. I think it's the decision to not recast Chadwick Boseman, not only to not recast him, but also not to try to fill his energy into the movie, right? There's no sort of comparable, charismatic male superhero lead. What this movie does is it brings the supporting cast, mostly female, from the original film, and lets them share center stage, right? It moves them into the sort of central roles to great effect, I think. That is, in many ways, the best decision, I think, that was made about this movie. And the fact that it exists at all is in some ways like kind of amazing. This is a movie that was in development when the lead actor died, like totally unexpectedly, as reports are that no one at Marvel knew about this, that this was, that he'd kept his cancer secret, which you can totally understand, because if you're a big box office star, that's the kind of thing that is going to cost you, and you want to be able to work as long as you can. And as we know, he worked right up to the very end, and like that's what he loved doing. So I think the movie works as a tribute. I think the decision to let, Letitia Wright and Lupita Nyong'o and some of the others, step into the central roles was a good one. But I largely agree with you. This movie is a disappointment and a mess, and it tries to do way too much. It is far too focused on setting up future Marvel properties. So that whole long, segment where we go to MIT and we meet the inventor of the vibranium machine, and she's built an Iron Man suit for herself, and she's going to be Ironheart because there's an Ironheart series that's in development for Disney Plus. And then there's also an Armor Wars movie that's in development that used to be a TV series, is blah, blah, who cares? And then like all the Julia Louis-Dreyfus stuff. Does anybody even know her actual name? Valentina Allegra de Fontaine, right? Like, who cares? Just Julia Louis-Dreyfus is like bad spy lady. And like, this is a 2 hour and 40 minute movie. And there's probably a solid 40 minutes of subplots that are not really directly relevant to the central conflict, that are just there to set up future MCU properties. It's like, it's 45 minutes of advertisement inside a 2 hour and 40 minute movie. And the advertisements aren't for, like, they don't fit. They don't make the movie better. And then I totally agree with you about the visuals in this movie. It just looks shockingly bad. It's dark, it's muddy, the CG is really ugly in many cases, even when it's bright. So the big attack scene on Wakanda, you get, Namor flying around with his little winged feet, and he's like bouncing around and stuff, and he's just like obviously changing size and scale relative to the buildings. He's obviously weirdly sort of goopy animated because as we know, Marvel doesn't care that much about this stuff and is constantly making changes right up to the last minute, which is both expensive and it leads to terrible looking effects. And then in addition to that, I am willing to accept shots that don't look great, as long as the shots are nicely composed and as long as the director has the confidence to give us, to like let us
understand what the shot is supposed to be. And so this is why I'm less hard on, say, some of the sort of underwhelming CG in something like House of the Dragon, because often the directors will give us these really interesting looking shots of, you know, in the finale there was that bit of the dragon flying through the clouds, and it was too dark. It was too dark for sure. And like the dragon rendering looked like it needed another couple of passes. But it was a really smart looking shot that was like, oh, that's a cool idea. I don't think there is a single memorable visual idea in this entire movie, unless you want to count the water explosions, which like that's a sort of cool technology, but it doesn't actually produce any shots that I was like, oh, that works. That's just even if the CG is sort of janky, even if it looks a little bit animated, that is going to be burned into my brain. And Marvel, for all of its sort of crappiness, does have those moments, but this movie had none of them, which is really pretty shocking for something this big, that it really just felt slapped together and kind of careless and artlessly crafted. And I don't, you know, like, I feel in some ways kind of bad slagging people's work like this, but it's really quite bad. And it's unpleasant to watch. And when you combine it with the narrative bloat, this movie just doesn't work. It's a huge disappointment. I don't think it's quite terrible. And it suffers from some of the same problems as, say, The Eternals. But it's a much better movie than The Eternals. But it's still not a very good one. And that's especially frustrating and disappointing since Black Panther, the first film, was it really is one of the better Marvel films, probably certainly top five and maybe top three.
Alyssa, what did you make of this? Because I want to specifically ask you about the look of this thing, because you wrote a column for the Washington Post about how like shockingly terrible it looks, and I think we all agree with that. I don't understand how something like this can make it to the big screen.
Yeah. And, you know, Peter was sitting next to me while I was watching this, and I think could observe that I was getting just increasingly agitated watching it. And it's particularly frustrating to me because there is some extremely strong design talent working on these movies. I mean, you have like a legendary costume designer, really interesting production designer. The sort of close-up look of a lot of what's happening in Wakanda, and even some of what's happening in the sort of cave complex, sort of outside of Talokan, is really beautiful in some ways. Like if you look at the costumes that T'Challa's, you know, relatives and, you know, like former guards are wearing during his funeral, you know, just the care that the movie puts into hairstyles, makeup, you know, jewelry. Like Namor's jewelry is really interesting. The sort of epic paintings that he's doing are really beautiful and, you know, colored in really interesting ways. And then for so much of the movie to just look like garbage is frustrating simply on it. Like, I think it is a disservice to the costume and production designers for Marvel to put out a movie that looks this bad in so many other respects. But to me, the failures of the visuals, you know, they undermine the narrative and ideas of the movie, right? You know, I mean, if you are supposed to be introduced to this undersea city of Talokan and it's supposed to be just totally overwhelming and, you know, beautiful and, you know, a little bit terrifying because, oh my God, there's this huge technically advanced undersea civilization, you have to be able to see it clearly. I mean, if the whole point of this scene is that we and Shuri are supposed to be just completely blown out of our seats by this, you have to be able to see what's going on in any given moment in that introductory scene, and you can't, right? I mean, the charitable argument is that this is like shot, you know, as if you're seeing it through real ocean water, but like, this is a Marvel movie. It doesn't need to be realistic. It needs to be convincing. And that scene in particular just is not, you know, in the same way the scenes of Namor, like sort of descending into his, you know, big shark jaw throne, just look like badly rendered video game stuff. I mean, I don't play a lot of video games, but like my understanding is that graphics there have gotten more sophisticated than even some of what we're seeing here. And it was just frustrating. I mean, a huge complaint, you know, I really, really hate very quick cut action scenes, in part because they destroy, for me anyway, sort of a sense of narrative. And they also just always seem to me to betray a lack of confidence in, you know, the stunt doubles or the actors. You know, it seems to suggest that the director and the editors don't think that what they've captured on screen is convincing. And, you know, to do this with, you know, the Dora Milaje repeatedly, to shoot the, you know, Boston chase and fight sequence at night such that it's just narratively incomprehensible, it just feels like malpractice to me. And again, like a disservice to the actors, to the second unit. I just find it really frustrating.
Well, it's also a marked downgrade from the original's. So the original had a very bad CGI action sequence at the end of the film, but it had some very good action stuff at the beginning of the film. The sequences set in Korea were actually very well done. There was a almost a James Bond type vibe to some of that stuff. And then, you know,
a big fight in a club that leads out into a car chase. And
those sequences I have some
qualms with, but they are really pretty good overall.
Certainly compared to what we see here, the chase through Boston in this movie is incomprehensibly shot. Just very bad. But let's get away from the visuals for a second, because I the biggest disappointment again to me was that this movie just does nothing interesting ideologically or intellectually with the actual story that it's telling. And one of the reasons I really like the first Black Panther is that it has there's an idea there. There's an, you know, Killmonger, who's played by Michael B. Jordan. This movie is also really missing Michael B. Jordan. The best scene in the film,
yes,
in this film is when he appears in the, you know, in the spirit world or whatever, the ancestral plane. You know, he's very good, and he is like compelling to watch on screen, and he is just magnetic in a way that sadly nobody else in this movie really is. But there was an interesting idea there. Killmonger had an idea about what it means to be Wakandan, what it means to actually push for, you know, equality and black liberation and whatever. Like, there's an interesting idea. There's an interesting idea, and this movie just doesn't do anything with it. Like, it does almost a watered down version of the same thing with the Talokans, and I just like. I found the whole thing very frustrating. I was like, there's a better movie in here if you are willing to not treat Wakanda as an eternal victim.
So there's an essential script problem, which is that Namor's conflict with the Wakandans is almost not dramatized. He shows up at the very beginning to sort of say, hey, we might invade you. And then there's this, you know, mid-movie sequence in which he explains his backstory and gives you a little tour. And then there's a big fight at the end. But there's no, like, Namor doesn't do anything to advance his cause in a real direct sense, except kind of sort of, you know, the kidnapping, whatever. But, like, even then, it's just so that he can deliver a monologue backstory sort of explaining his motivation. And then we just get a fight. And it's... There's no, like, in order for conflict to, you know, to sort of to have meaning and to come alive in a movie, the characters have to actually be working to advance their cause. And Namor doesn't do that here. He just sort of says stuff and then there's fighting.
Well, and it's particularly a shame because you could build on the argument that was made in the first movie and say, look, you know, Talokan and Wakanda are rooted in very different experiences of colonialism, right? Like, Wakanda avoids it altogether and commits this sort of great moral atrocity by sitting outside of it. The people of Talokan, or at least their leader, have direct experience with what it means to be colonized on every level, right? I mean, they understand the resource exploitation, they've experienced disease, they've seen, you know, just slavery and total brutality. And if you saw Wakanda sort of acting more in the world earlier in the movie, and if you saw sort of that pressure ratcheting up on them to start selling vibranium and saw that being something that was just like harder for Queen Ramonda to resist. Like if that was sort of the price of becoming part of the international order, you could have a debate about like international engagement. You could have a different facet of the sort of international engagement versus isolationism argument that I think would be interesting. But I think it would require a different conflict, right? Like, and I think that a situation where you're talking about where, you know, Talokan launches some kind of first strike would be really interesting. And then you have sort of a debate around that. And if you have Shuri be like, you know, you have this early thing where she's like, oh, I just want to see the whole world burn. Okay, but that's not intellectually developed, right? I mean, like, what if you actually say, like, King T'Challa dies? Like, what if he's murdered by a bioweapon? What if it's an assassination, right? Like, what if there's some actual tension around generated out of his death that makes Shuri, like, much more actually inclined to ally with Talokan other than, like, Namor's kind of hot and charming. And I will say, once again, just, like, the essential sexlessness of these movies is kind of a problem. Like, you know, the whole sort of vibe between the two of them is much more comprehensible if Shuri, like, runs off and, like, bangs him for a while. Like, has her been, like, they have a, you know, they have an affair. There's some sort of, like, you know, she's sort of sewing these, like, there's, but the lack of sort of sexual vibe, especially, you know, the movie's sort of essential sexlessness when you realize that, like, oh, you know, T'Challa had a secret kid. It just,
sure,
it emphasizes the extent to which these are just not really grown-up movies, right? I mean, like, Nakia might as well have had that kid by, like, parthenogenesis for all the, like, actual contact we saw between her and T'Challa. You know, it's just, it's very weird.
Yeah. All right. Running along here. So what did we think of Black Panther, Wakanda Forever? Thumbs up or thumbs down? Peter?
Thumbs down, sadly.
Alyssa?
Yeah, regrettable thumbs down. I told my husband I would not willingly see it again.
Wow. That's bad sign. All right, thumbs down. It's really not very good, and it's disappointingly not very good, which is the worst part. I don't mind when a movie is an interesting failure, but this is an uninteresting failure, and that's inexcusable. All right, that is it for this week's show. Make sure to swing by atma.thebulwark.com for our bonus episode on Friday. Make sure to tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we will die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll come into that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.